Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to Aquaman. Aquaman does whatever an aqua can. Releases songs about Barbie girls and Indiana Jones and other things as well. Look out! Here comes the Aquaman. No? Okay.
No.
This one is dedicated to the sixth film in the DCEU. Yes, six. We counted them. Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, colon Dawn of Justice, Justice League, Wonder Woman, that one about the Suicide Squad, I forget what it's called, and now this one, James Wan's Aquaman. How exciting.
It is. Exciting is a word.
It is. There are many, many words to describe Aquaman. Joining me over the next hour or so to discuss the most movie ever made are two very watery colleagues of such lethal cunning and huge Aqua fans as well. In case you didn't know what I was doing in the intro, that was the band Aqua. If you've heard of the band Aqua, right? Dr. Jones.
I've tried to forget, but I have heard of them, yes. I'm aware of their existence.
Come on, Barbie, let's go party.
Yeah.
Right.
Helen O'Hara, our geek queen, is here.
Hello. Look, there has to be a level that I, you know, beyond which I do not stoop. And Aqua is under that sea level, if you will.
One day we will find a level beyond which I do not stoop. But today,
no, we won't.
A level does not exist. We're also joined by our very own Travis Fickle. Ben Travis, how are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I'm going to, full disclosure here, I think I have more questions than answers when it comes to Aquaman. I have so many questions. And I think hopefully this will be a bit of a post-Aquaman therapy session where we just kind of help each other process what we've seen, see what we've learned from that.
Yep.
But yes, I will be here as the question person going, what was this about?
Totally fine.
Why?
We come not to bury Aquaman, but to kind of ironically praise him.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely
a lot of
there's a lot of fun stuff in this, but then there have to be, because there's a lot of stuff in this. Like,
yeah,
there's so much stuff in this film. It's, you know, if you met someone who'd never seen a blockbuster movie, you know, they'd spent their entire life in the art house somewhere, and they were like, well, what do these blockbusters do? What should I see? And I only have money, by the way, for one ticket. This is the one you'd send them to. This is every blockbuster, all wrapped up in one underwater weirdness. It's Lord of the Rings. There's elements of Lord of the Rings. There's elements of Star Wars. There's obviously superhero elements. You know, it goes a bit Jurassic Park one bit for no obvious reason. Clash of the Titans is in there, you know.
You learn about history?
Black, for some reason. History.
There's history lessons in there?
Yeah.
Yeah, you get to learn about Pinocchio, which apparently is a book.
I didn't
know that.
I thought it was just a film.
Oh, God, you're both as bad as Aquaman.
Honestly.
In fact, you're worse, because you don't look like Jason Momoa.
That's fair.
I think I look better than Jason Momoa, actually. Thank you very much indeed.
Agree to disagree, Chris.
From a distance.
Agree to disagree, Chris. So.
Anyway, so let's get into the film they call Aquaman. And before we do so, Ben has a lot of questions, and I'm glad you had a lot of questions, Ben, because I also had a lot of questions. Luckily, the director of Aquaman... I'm going to stop saying it like that. Luckily, the director of Aquaman, James Wan, was on hand to answer a bunch of those questions, including one. Well, we'll get to that. Maybe after this. But first, here it is, my interview with James Wan. But before we do that, a quick spoiler special warning. This is a spoiler special. We are going to get into the film, third act revelations, major deaths, not that there really are any, all that sort of stuff, in great detail, starting from this interview with James Wan. So if you haven't seen Aquaman, Helen, what did they do?
Go away.
Go away?
Yeah, but go and see Aquaman.
Go and see Aquaman.
And then come back.
And then come back.
And then listen
and then
to this.
Go away again.
No. When they've seen Aquaman.
When you've seen Aquaman.
They can stay with us.
And then fuck off.
No.
Then you stay.
No, they stay.
You stay and you listen to more of the podcast.
That's right.
Anyway, should we have the interview with James Wan?
Yes, please.
Here it is, me talking to James Wan.
Delighted to be joined in this Aquaman spoiler special podcast by the director of Aquaman, Mr. James Wan. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You excited to be talking spoilers for a film? What have you been able to say to people about this film for the last 2 years? Jason Momoa is in it and has got some fish. That's pretty much it.
It has been hard to do interviews and stuff like that and wanting to get into, you know, a little bit more of the nitty and gritty of it all, but not being able to say too much without spoiling stuff. So this is kind of cool.
Well, let's get into it, shall we?
Yeah,
because
let's do it.
I always ask the big question on everyone's lips, the squid playing drums.
Ah, yes. Topo.
It has a name.
Oh, yeah. Listen, he is a fan favorite character, believe it or not, from the Silver Age comic book.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, he wasn't just some random character that I threw in there. When my writers and I were working on this early on, you know, we loved this character so much. You know, like if you go back and look at Google this character now, Topo, and you will see he actually is a really fun sort of like a sidekick slash pet character for Aquaman.
Amazing.
Yeah, and he would play all these like kind of really sort of fun musical instruments and he would do all these kind of like really sort of funny sort of silly things and you know, very befitting to the Silver Age comic book that it came from. You know, he'll be like, you know, sort of serving Aquaman with like literally like in one hand he'll be holding like a serving tray, uh-huh, and in the other tentacle he'll be like holding something else. And so you know, I just wanted to kind of embrace that and just find, you know, give him a little sort of Easter egg cameo.
Oh my word, well I stand corrected, but that's amazing because I just saw him as a squid playing drums and I thought,
oh no,
in a weird way that summed up certainly the last third of this movie, because this is bonkers.
It's definitely not afraid or not shy to kind of embrace its origin. I can definitely say that. Yeah.
In a way, I don't think, I mean, this DCEU even began with a 20-minute sequence on Krypton and Man of Steel where Russell Crowe is riding a flying dragon.
Right.
But I don't think I've seen anything like where you go in the last 30 minutes of this movie, which is insane.
Well, listen, I mean, I just feel like, you know, coming in into, you know, a property like this, that you gotta just kind of like, you know, embrace all the quirkiness that the comic book, you know, character, that the comic book was, you know, for so long. And yes, you know, you can really make him a very dead serious character. I just didn't, that wasn't the movie that I necessarily wanted to make.
Yeah.
I wanted to make like a really fun sort of vibrant sort of world creation movie and just kind of embrace that and just really lean into it and not be afraid to be afraid to sort of pull all the sort of the strange, weird and wonderful stuff that were in the comic books.
I mean, it's a film that gave me sights I never thought I would see in a blockbuster. It gave me sights I never thought I wanted to see in a blockbuster. For example, in a conversation between a man riding a giant shark and a giant crab. But now I've seen that, I realize it was all that's missing from my life. And everything's
good. Well, I mean, that's really it. You know, like part of my goal with sort of building this world, I really wanted to make it, first and foremost, part of the reason why I... what drew me to this project was the fact that I got the opportunity to kind of, you know, I get the chance to do this sort of really sort of really out there sort of world creation film. And that opportunity meant that I could really, you know, look into the Seven Kingdoms of the underwater world. You know, majority of the underwater world are human looking people. You know, and then you start to sort of like evolve into certain different sort of underwater sort of a race of people, right? And so you know, you have the race of people that are the fishermen people that are mer people, and then you have the trench creatures that are basically just, you know, sort of
what the hell are they?
Well, they're kind of like this sort of underwater basically underwater sea monsters is what they are. And then of course, you know, you have the brine kingdom, which going to this just meant that I just let my imagination loose, and I love the idea that I can create a race of crustacean people I think that's what makes it really fun and really just so enjoyable for myself when I was first designing each of these different worlds, is to just let loose.
And damn straight. I mean, the there's that visual as Arthur and Mira are diving and pursued by all the different creatures from the Kingdom of the Trench. That is, that's just an amazing shot. That sequence where they're attacked by the creatures from the Kingdom of the Trench, that feels, there's a moment in Spider-Man 2 where Doc Ock comes to life and it feels like Sam Raimi's going, okay, right, I made some horror films in the day, I'm going to show you kids what I can do. And in the midst of all this madness, it felt like this is the James Wan, the horror director, who was having a laugh.
Yeah, I say that you know, the world, like the sort of the oceanic world, is very you know, it can be very magical and wondrous, right? But at the same time, it can be very scary and dangerous too. And I feel like this film really allows me to play with those two very different aesthetic. You know, so we visit kingdoms that are very kind of vibrant, bright, and colorful, and very sort of ethereal. But then I can go the other way as well, go to the other extreme end of that spectrum and create a world that is just very kind of dark and scary and you know, and still sort of be part of the story, be part of the journey that our heroes go through. And I just had a lot of fun doing that. From that sequence, I actually derive a signature look kind of throughout the film, which is the sort of visual cross-section of the ocean. So you see the top part of the screen, you see what's above the surface. Mm-hmm. And then the bottom half of the screen is what's below the surface. And so that cross-section, basically what we call it like an ant farm kind of look, became somewhat of a signature look that I wanted the movie to have throughout the film. And we have that in quite a few places, but I think it looked the best, you know, during the trench sequence.
Oh, it's fantastic at just suggesting the scale of this thing.
Yeah, the scale, and also from a thematic standpoint, that our hero is a man who's off the surface world, and half surface dweller, a half Atlantean, and I feel like a shot like that just thematically shows, like, you know what's above and what's below.
Let's get into some of the more plot specific stuff now. I'm fascinated with how movies like this begin and how movies like this end. Mm-hmm. And you begin this with Atlanta falling in love with Tom Curry. And in a way, you end the movie with that as well. It ends with that shot of Arthur leaping out the sea and looking at the camera. Were you tempted at any point to bookend the film with the Atlanta Tom scenes as well?
Well, I mean, to me, it is bookended. That was always the intention. But, you know, you got to finish it with Aquaman himself, right? The movie isn't called Tom and Atlanta. The movie is called Aquaman. But you know, just in terms of structure, that was always the plan, was to kind of bookend the movie. You know, the movies, to me, the relationship between mom and dad is the emotional backbone for the whole movie. You know, like Arthur feels the way he does, his piss and with Atlantis, because he kind of blames them for, you know, killing his mother.
Who he never knew.
And so he has, a chip off his shoulder because of that. And because of that, you know, he's never visited Atlantis and doesn't care about them and doesn't, you know, give two shits about these people, right? Even though they are his people as well. And so through the course of that, you know, he goes through that sort of classic hero's journey to discover who he is and what he's supposed to be, and where he fits in this world, and you know, he goes on this hero's journey to become the king that he's supposed to be. And I always felt that I didn't, you know, there was one version early on where Atlanta's character actually dies in the story.
Okay.
And I just didn't feel like that was the right way to do. I feel like I wanted that sort of full, emotionally come full circle, you know, the father going to the end of the dock, the end of the pier, you know, every morning. There's just something so romantic and sentimental about it. And partly because that I think that's just, you know, the romantic nature that I have, you know, not many people know that despite the the horror films I've made.
I think Lorraine and Ed have a pretty random relationship.
Well, that's true. I think the Conjuring films are actually closer to who I am in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, so I really want to come sort of full circle in that sort of like the love story aspect of that.
Yeah.
And I just think, the movie is kind of very sentimental at heart. It plays to the sort of the romance that we have, you know, of the nautical world. It just felt like the right thing to do.
So at what point was the decision made to keep Atlanta alive and have her come back? Is that big reveal towards the end of the film?
It was during the the story process. Yeah. Mm. It wasn't something that we shoehorned there in.
Well,
the very
3 weeks before the end of the film.
Yeah, exactly. No. It was something that we knew we wanted to do at the early story stage, and then before we started scripting it. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Because when she comes back into the action, she obviously has a huge galvanizing effect on Arthur, but also she has an interesting effect on King Orm as well.
Yes.
The first hint, I would say, that there is a soul there, that there is an internal struggle within him.
Within King Orm?
Within King Orm, yeah.
Yeah, I think, actually the first time we really feel that, I think, is in the Colosseum battle, you know, when he sort of faces off with Arthur. Mm-hmm. And he's fully just, you know, like classic sort of kind of comic book villainy, you know, like Atlantis is gonna rise again and we're gonna mess up your world. And then and what I like about that moment is Jason throughout the whole movie is like this hammer, right? Like he just beats anything up. And then when he got to that moment, we wanted to do something that was very unexpected. He went, instead of going hard, he went soft. He went the other direction, and he tried to kind of connect with his brother emotionally.
Yes.
And I think Patrick is so great, you know, in the way that Patrick does his thing, and you kind of see his character gets caught off guard by that.
Oh, yeah,
and it's played so well, you know, by Patrick Wilson, you know, and just sort of like he sees it and for a moment there he doesn't quite know what to do with his guard. Is his guard up or is it slightly down? And at that very moment he basically tells me, listen, he says, I don't want to kill you. You know, like, I'm gonna give you one chance here. Go. Go, you know, don't ever come back to Atlantis. I don't want to kill you. I have nothing against you. The throne is mine. Don't try and take it. And this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be bringing this to the surface. Well, whether you like it or not, I mean, he says those words. And that's a moment between the two of them that I really like. I know there's a lot of visual spectacles and action in the film, but it's the quiet moments in this film that I love the most. And that's one of them.
Interesting. So there is something inside Orm. He has the potential to love, which is
well. I mean, yes, and like you said, when Mum finally shows up, it's just a boy with mummy issues. They're both of them. They have like big mummy issues. They just need Mum around to hold their hands. I mean, listen. Old jokes aside, it actually is a story that does touch a lot about sort of your upbringing, right? Orm was brought up by King Ovax, the dad, and it raised to be, you know, like just to be very, you know, somewhat ignorant and just be sort of very nationalistic. Mm-hmm. And then Arthur was raised by the father, you know, like, you know, with love and compassion and all that. And so you see how the two of them works, even though they're related, that they were raised differently. But they all have Mom, you know, as the common goal, and they both love their mom.
The power of the mother. It's amazing. Arthur, of course, grows up not knowing what Pinocchio is a book, but luckily Tom does teach him a lot about history, which is which is good. Works out nicely in the end.
Yes, that's definitely that's something that we go, you know what? He doesn't know that Pinocchio is a book. He saw it from the film. And I feel like, you know, only Jason Momoa can pull that off.
I believe he doesn't own a TV set, Jason.
You mean the real Jason?
Yeah.
Yeah, he it's pretty incredible.
I'm not sure if Arthur owns one either, to be honest. But yeah, what would he watch? What could possibly... Yeah,
that'd be funny if that's the first thing he sets up in the Throne of Atlantis is he sets up cable.
We can get great fiber optic cable down here on the seafloor.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely. He just sort of like, disconnect it and repatch it to his bedroom.
But the film is very much about Arthur, I think, growing as a person, obviously, and proving himself worthy of the throne. And you start with Atlanta and Tom and the birth of Arthur, but you then move on to effectively the introduction of, I would say, the film's secondary villain, yep. Black Manta. And that's really interesting, given Arthur's part in his origin and the choice that Arthur makes.
Right.
Vis-a-vis his dad.
Right. Yeah, it's it definitely is a really kind of fine needle to thread on this particular film. Just because from the get-go that we knew that the story needed to get to the throne of Atlantis, right? Because yeah. Arthur needs to become the king. And so we going into it, we know that our main antagonist of this movie would have to be King Aurum, would have to be because he sits on the throne. And so we knew that that was our main story thrust. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you can do an Aquaman story and not have Black Manta in there, because I think the fans would just riot. And so so then the question becomes, like, how do we... At least for me, like I don't like the idea of necessarily having two villains, mm-hmm. or at least having two villain plot. And so it was very important that that even though both Black Manta and King Aurum have different reasons for going after Arthur, mm-hmm. for disliking Arthur, at least their end goal is the same. So, like, so, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that mm-hmm. they come together, that they work together, you know, is a classic one that it's in the comic book, it's in the animated show. So it didn't feel out of place to kind of bring the two of them together. But also always for me, knowing that at the end of the day, this is a King Aurum sort of story and not Black Manta's story.
Yes.
And so it was important to, you know, to know that he is a side character, but going to it, having his character be set up in a way like you know, like the antagonism with Arthur is ultimately what creates Black Manta. And I just think like that the irony there is really interesting, that he is meeting this guy at the start of the film and confronting him and being so sort of nonchalant about and just not being compassionate enough to help save the father character, yeah, like even though he's they're bad guys, right?
Who've you know, killed a lot of people. Yeah,
exactly. They kill a lot of people, but the whole idea here is Arthur at the start of the movie, he's not quite the hero that he's supposed to be yet, right? Mm. And so he just let that go, and in the process, he ends up creating a nemesis for life. You know, and I think that's a really interesting thing to also helping Arthur realize that it's Black Manta in a roundabout way gives Arthur his sort of hero's arc, his yeah. journey to yeah. become who he needs to be,
and teaches him that actions have consequences as well. Well, he just can't exactly. be glib and blasé about stuff either.
Oh, especially you know for someone who'd become a superhero, right?
Yeah, precisely. You also revisit Black Manta. You keep him on the board. You keep him alive for the post-credit sting. And it is interesting because I was watching the film and I'm going, that's Randall Park as Dr. Shin. And then he doesn't appear again until the very end of the movie. So was there more Randall Park initially? Or is this just literally just setting him up?
Yeah, Randall Park was more like, you know, like a bigger cameo, basically. I'm a big Randall Park fan. I've loved the guy for the longest part. I'm such a big fan of Fresh Off the Boat and everything else that he's done in the film world. Mm. And so I really wanted to get him in this movie in some way. And so, you know, getting him to play Randall Shin, who is also another character staple in the comic book, meant that I could sort of kind of, you know, touch a little bit on his world. And you know, if we're fortunate enough to have future stories, I'd love to see more of him for sure.
Okay, interesting. You know where you're going with this, James.
I don't. But,
all right, no worries.
I'm making shit up as I go along, Chris.
It's the best way to do it, man. It's the best way to do it. I want to talk about the relationship between Arthur and Mira, which is this mm-hmm. really kind of sparky, kind of Catherine Hepburn, Humphrey Bogart vibe you got going on there. They're quite mm-hmm. Spiky towards each other throughout.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that definitely was the inspiration for myself and the writers. It is very much in the old school kind of way.
Yeah, she thinks he's an idiot.
She thinks he's an idiot. He is an idiot. To be right, she's right. He is an idiot and a very goofy, likable idiot, mind you, but yep. But still, nonetheless. And, you know, and she kind of has no choice. She kind of needs him. And he needs her as well. And so, you know, they go on this sort of adventure together to try and stop King Orm. And, you know, from the get-go, their relationship in the comic book is a big part of why the fans really love them. Like, Mera in the comic book is just as powerful as Arthur, or just as beloved.
Mm.
And in a lot of ways, she is physically more powerful than he is. And so you know, we wanted to create a Mera character that was strong, and coming into this, Amber really wanted to create a very strong female character that young girls can look up to. And I think you know, that was a very important thing for the both of us to do that, and to see that she is not a damsel in distress.
Yep.
Like, she doesn't need saving from Arthur. If anything, she saves his butt again and again throughout the film. But that's part of the dynamic there between the two of them. When he's in her world, he's the fish out of water. When she's in his world, she's the fish out of water there.
Yeah.
So you know,
were you tied down away at all by the brief scene they had together in Justice League? Because here she seems to be meeting him for the first time. Or he's meeting her for the first time. They don't seem to know each other.
They don't. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I actually ended up being a good thing that they had that brief scene in Justice League, mm-hmm. right? Meaning that their relationship, you know, wasn't fully developed in any way, or it was just a meeting. And, you know, when he in this standalone movie, when he sees her, he knows who she is, and then, you know, she says, I need you to come back with me to Atlanta. He's like, oh, no, go away. And so, you know, he knows why she's here, or he knows it's going to be for something that he doesn't want to be a part of.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of where we picked up.
Okay.
Right. Which is great, because then it gives me kind of more freedom to be able to kind of create the relationship between the two.
The moment when Mera and Arthur kiss maybe has one of my favorite and rudest visual gags in some time. And this may be
you're gonna have to explain that.
This may be unintentional, but I don't think anything's unintentional in a movie like this. So as they kiss, the camera circles around him,
uh-huh.
and Arthur raises his trident from a downward angle to an upward angle. Explain yourself, James Wan.
You know, I'm cracking up now because...
Because I got you.
They were... takes. We did different takes, obviously, that didn't necessarily have that sort of visual, I wouldn't want to describe that, that particular look.
Yeah.
But I...
Erection joke, James. We can call it what it is.
I'm trying to be... I'm trying not to go there. There were lots of different takes, and not all of them had that look. But I ended up going with this particular take because uh-huh. Just overall, it was just a better take. But I was very aware of the
tell it to the judge, pal.
I was very aware of like the euphemism that comes with the action.
Yes.
You know, I'm hoping that the audience don't read too much into it.
Of course not.
If they do, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I just want to say it wasn't necessarily the outright intention.
Okay.
The intention of that shot was to actually create a very romantic visual, which is, you know, the camera rotates around them, uh-huh. and you know, and we have Skylar Grey's really beautiful sort of music playing in the background. At least just, you know, the instrumental version of Skylar Grey's song, yes. playing around that, and then have, like, you know, the explosions in the background sort of time to the beat of the music.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like my little sort of musical interlude in the film.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would just say they were, you know, better intentions than the one you're picking up now.
I'm just a filthy minded fool. What can I say?
But I wouldn't fight you on this regardless.
All right, fair enough. Last question, James. Julie Andrews, Dame Julie Andrews, mm-hmm. as the most powerful sea creature on the planet.
Course. Of course.
Makes perfect sense.
Makes perfect sense. Yeah, going into this, the casting of this role, I knew that I wanted it to be, that the creature to be a female. Because, yeah. of course, it would be, a female would be the most powerful creature on Earth. And for some reason, I really wanted her to be British. I don't know why. I really wanted her to be British because I just really wanted this really, you know, like, you don't see all of these creatures. That's how big she is, right? And so you only see, like, basically, like, you see her tentacles. So that'd be the equivalent of, like, just seeing her toes, her fingers, right? I was definitely, you know, thinking of, you know, the likes of the three dames, Dame Helen Mirren, Dame mm-hmm. Judi Dench, and Dame Julie Andrews. Those three were the kind of like my inspiration for what I wanted the character to sound like.
Yeah.
I love Julie Andrews. What can I say? I've been such a big fan growing up, you know, with her stuff, you know, as a kid. And so we just thought, let's give it a shot, you know, like, you know, we didn't think that she might necessarily do it because, you know, there's this other movie coming out that she's kind of famous for as well. So I don't think, who knows if she will do our film. And we reached out to her, and apparently she told me that I think her grandson is a big fan of my films and would really love to see her kind of participate in one of my projects. And I have her grandson to thank for that.
Amazing.
And she's just so lovely. I had such a great time, you know, just working with her on this. And I can finally say I got the opportunity to direct Julie Andrews.
That's extraordinary. James Wan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
So that was James Wan there, and now it is time for us to dig deep into mm-hmm. Aquaman. And I think we should start with where I ended with James Wan, which was what I consider to be one of the greatest stealth dick jokes in the history of cinema. So you know what I'm talking about. It's at the end of the movie, Arthur, Arthur Curry, our lovable hero, has kissed Mira for the first time, right? Mm-hmm. Ben, I know you're quite young, but you're going to have to listen to this. When an Aquaman loves an Aquawoman, mm-hmm. okay, and his little trident jumps to attention, okay, that's usually a sign that, you know, he's ready for the aqua loving. And there's the shot of mm-hmm. Arthur and Mira, and they're having their first kiss, right? And Arthur's snogging, and Arthur's trident is pointed downwards. And as the camera swirls around them, I mean, this is a film in which the camera never stops swirling. The camera swirls around. Watch this film again, Ben. Mm-hmm. Watch this film again. Keep your eyes peeled for this. Okay. But at the same time, cover your eyes, Ben, because you're innocent and I don't want you to lose that innocence. It's important to me.
You would never do that to me. You would never destroy the innocence.
No.
Herein.
The trident changes its angle, Ben. It changes its angle. Yeah, it goes full carry-on up the Atlantis towards the end. And James Wan, as you probably just heard there, people who listened to the interview, you know, he basically confirmed that that was his intent. So that's a fairly ballsy move, I would say.
Well, even following on from the beginning of the film where Papa Curry finds a woman on the rocks.
Tom Curry. How dare you?
Finds Nicole Kidman on the rocks, takes her back to his lighthouse. Yeah. Sure. She eats his goldfish. Then she clearly displays that she has very little understanding of the human world. And then they bang.
I mean, there's a bit of time that you're kind of leaving out there.
But so does the film, yes, basically.
It does leave it out. But, like, I mean, come on, we can be too woke about these things. I don't think the implication is meant to be that, you know, they just get it on. And no, come on. By the time we meet her again, she's speaking English. It's fine, honestly. I'm decreeing it. It's fine.
Okay, that's fine. That's good.
Watching it again, actually, I noticed that we are, of course, in Amnesty Bay, Maine at that point. That's interesting because I kind of assumed from the heritage of those two male leads that we might be in the sort of Pacific somewhere, uh-huh. That we'd be maybe in New Zealand or somewhere on the northwest coast of the US. But we are actually in Maine, which makes a lot of the film's other geography make fractionally more sense than it otherwise would, which is the good news, but only fractionally more because it's still terrible.
What are your geographical issues with this film, Helen?
So we're in Maine. That puts Atlantis presumably somewhere in the Atlantic, which would make sense from a legendary point of view in terms of the legends, not the film company, legendary.
And presumably, I'm showing my ignorance here, but it wouldn't be the first time in this podcast. Presumably Atlantis derives its name from the Atlantic?
I guess connected, but it's all, I think, comes from the same, I want to say Greek root, but don't quote me on that, for goodness sake. But it is an ancient European legend, the legend of Atlantis, the island that sank beneath the waves. So it sort of wouldn't entirely make sense as a European legend if it was in the Pacific. But the problem is, the problems come in with, like, lots of the other stuff. Like, I would have thought that the trench would have been the Marianas Trench, which is, of course, the deepest point we know about on the surface of the Earth. But presumably it's not, because it's in the Atlantic, because they can get there in a boat from Sicily. Which obviously upset me, because it should, if it's in the Atlantic, presumably be somewhere down the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or something like that, which is where all the activity is, like, you know, volcanically speaking.
These are the same notes I made.
Yeah.
So. And, you know, that's a long way from Sicily, is all I'm saying. But I guess their craft is, like, powered by Atlante and magic or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Exact same notes I made, mm-hmm. except mine were more along the lines of, is that a hard-on joke? Circled. And a little hard.
And also, Black Manta is somewhere in the North Sea at one point, and I don't know, I haven't spent a lot of time in the North Sea. I don't think it looks like that at all, but, I mean, sure, I guess.
I mean, okay. Every time one of those cards came up, I just smiled and nodded and just thought, okay, different ocean bit. It's wet, yeah. But it's a different bit of the ocean.
This is sort of film, you know, this isn't even remotely trying to be realistic. Nothing took me out of the film the way that, say, Thor fucking up the directions to Greenwich.
Oh my God, I mean, that was awful.
From Charing Cross. I mean, which is just, I mean, that's just the nadir of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I don't care. Oh, one seed looks much like the other, Helen. You know, I don't want to be seist in any way here, shape or form, but I'm just saying that it doesn't really matter to me. It's all fine as long as you get your Aquaman fun and your Aquaman spectacle.
But then,
and we did.
Later, Mamba's in the Indian Ocean. Again, like, no reason. How did he get there?
But how did he get there? What is going on?
And also, I have questions about the Atlantean skin. Like, shouldn't they be secreting a lot of oil to keep their skin nice underwater? And shouldn't going into the Sahara be a problem for them? I don't know why this really pulled me out of the film, but genuinely, I was like, I was worried about them dehydrating in the Sahara. I felt like if your body is accustomed to having a lot of water around you at all times, that being in the Sahara would be genuinely bad for your health.
I mean, that was my top note, just said needs more oil secretion, yeah. Underlined with an exclamation mark next to it.
Hey, I have never knowingly overthought these things, so.
One of my biggest questions was, how did sort of regular size Tamara Morrison and sort of regular size
Nicole Kidman
have such a large Aquaboy?
Can I just say, Nicole Kidman, if you've met her, is not regular size.
She's
like 6'5". She's certainly 5'11" if she's a day.
Mm-hmm.
And if she's a day, then she's almost 6'1".
Oh.
Wait, what?
I'm using the metric system. So those two, I can see how...
Okay. My first question answered. There we go.
No, little parents can produce huge, great, big titans.
He's so big.
Do you think Anthony Hopkins and Rennie Russo produced Thor?
Yes.
All right, fair enough.
I also had questions about the behaviour of lava underwater, but I realised that might be getting into it too much as well. But that Ring of Fire, it didn't entirely convince me in its physics, but perhaps the Atlanteans have some sort of way of controlling lava that they use for popular games. Also, where was health and safety in that arena? I mean, it just seemed very badly conceived.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most dangerous tournament since the Triwizard tournament. just no health and safety, it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there you've got dragons flying around. Here you have, you know, Jason Momoa flying at you at full speed. Like, that would be a problem.
The crowd loved it, though. That shot where the crowd goes, "Way!" always makes me smile.
How many times have you seen this film?
Once.
Just once. Okay. I've only seen the film once, I'm afraid. I tried to get to see it twice, but the slurgy that you may be able to hear in my voice from time to time sadly got in the way of me going to see it a second time. Helen has seen it a second time.
I have, yes.
And, you know, I think we should start up. We should probably get back on track for this film, because I really enjoyed Aquaman. There are elements of it I didn't enjoy. There are elements of it I think didn't entirely work, but I absolutely respect James Wan's dedication to just throwing everything he possibly can at this movie, at this concept, which we have to say is a silly one.
Yeah.
And, you know, any director who comes into this world with this character, you're up against it. Whether it's Aquaman or whether it's Namor the Submariner, and I know there are rights issues that have maybe stopped Marvel from doing something with that character, or, you know, certainly in the past. But there may also be an issue where they've just gone, we're not entirely sure how to make this work. So fair play to James Wan and Warner Brothers and DC for giving it a good old go.
It feels to me like they have learned a little bit from the more successful Marvel films, where every time they have to push that concept further and you go, how are they going to do this? And the answer is just to lean into it. Lean into the craziness, lean into the comic bookiness. Don't try and ground it too much and take away what that actually is. One of the things I really admired about the film, not just that it was kind of so much Aquaman in terms of it just being a huge, huge blockbuster spectacle, but also because it felt a little bit like, this might be the only Aquaman film we do, and if it is, we want it to be the most Aquaman film possible. That, yes, it was, for me, it was like way too long, and the whole Black Manta storyline was cool, but it was like a massive addition that didn't really actually change anything else in the plot. But I kind of admired that they thought, let's just do that storyline anyway. We can continue it if we get a sequel, but let's not leave it and then have it as a kind of, oh, well, this time we might do this in case they don't get a second film. It's like, let's just do it now and give people a full-on Aquaman experience. Let's use everything this character has. And then if people respond to it, hopefully we'll get to take it even further next time.
I mean, I don't know what they've left themselves with, to be honest. But no, I think there's an element of that. I think it's also just trying to, you know, raise the bar and fight against what's out there. I think Jason Momoa brings an enormous amount to Aquaman. Now, admittedly, I haven't read that many of his comics, but he's always been a bit of a nothing character to me. And what they've basically done here, it seems to me, is to a fairly large degree make him a bit Jason Momoa-y. And that, I think, is no bad thing, because then he has a bit of attitude, a bit of character, and something different to the sort of royal scions we've seen before in these comic book movies. So that's kind of good. I mean, you know, in terms of Manta, the problem I have with that is, like, some of the story is so badly written. I think that the scene in the actual torpedo room is great, but the scene leading up to that with your grandfather's knife and all this stuff is terrible. Yeah, it's like, really bad.
Why wait till that moment to give him the knife?
Why wait? You're in the middle of essentially a heist, guys. You don't have time for this. You shouldn't have time for this. So yeah, I had a bit of an issue with that. I did enjoy in that opening sub scene, though, the fact that every time Aquaman did anything remotely cool, there was an outrageously over the top guitar riff for it.
Oh, this is not a subtle movie.
That's true.
It's a movie that fears silence. It's just like any time that Arthur, Fakari and Mira have even like the hint of a moment alone, something loud has to come crashing through a window or land on top of them or attack them or something like that. They can't have a moment's peace. It's a film that takes the sort of the Smashing Pumpkins quiet, quiet, loud template and applies it to movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we spoke on the regular pod just about how I know other people in the same screening as me just felt basically exhausted by it by the time it ends, because it is so full on for pretty much 2.5 solid hours, and you're constantly trying to keep up with it because the tone is changing every kind of 10 to 15 minutes. It feels like you're watching a different film in a way that's kind of fun but also baffling. Yeah. And you just have to surrender yourself to it, because it feels like the aim of Arthur and Mira's quest keeps changing, and where they're having to go to, it's quite episodic in that way, and each episode within that has a different tone. One's a bit like a horror film, and one's a bit like Mamma Mia, and one's a bit Indiana Jones. And so, honestly, as soon as they got to Italy, my partner turned to me and said, is this Mamma Mia now? And then Mira started doing all the sort of dolphin water things from the statue, and it was like, this is so unabashedly, unashamedly cheesy and campy. But then it would go to trying to be, there were moments at the end that actually felt very Zack Snyder-y to me, in the final confrontation between Orm and Aquaman, where you have Orm in the full costume with a sort of flowing cape and in against the dark night sky.
Yeah,
that was very Zack Snyder, and it just feels like the whole thing is just a bit of everything. And I think there will be something in this film for pretty much everyone, but I think that means that for a lot of people, vast chunks of it won't work. Do you know what I mean? Like there's little bits all the way through for everyone, because it's just doing everything from moment to moment. But I think for some of the people who really like the darkness, the intensity of the Zack Snyder stuff, a lot of the kind of more, like I said, unashamedly, almost joyously, unabashedly cheesy, campy stuff won't work for them, whereas other people who like that will really enjoy that, but maybe not enjoy some of the crashy-bashy.
Yeah, it is bits. Mostly the campy stuff, though, I think, in this one. If anything, for me, it really needed more Momoa, just giving him a chance, and her a chance, to just hang out and be people, because I think the little tiny scenes that they had, that was really fun, but there's just so much exhausting stuff going on. And it's, and also, just some, can I just highlight some of the dialogue for a minute? We've got lines like, I'm bringing the wrath of the seven seas with me.
Mm-hmm. Seems fine.
They were fighting until, until the gods make known their will, by bloodshed, till the gods make known their will. You know, stuff like the Atlantis has always had a king, now it needs something more. Today we unite our kingdoms, tomorrow we scorch the surface.
Wow.
I mean, dude, you've already caused a huge global tsunami.
All right.
So,
because I think the film's kind of flitting around from tone to tone is interesting. So you do get the James Wan horror film of the evil toothy creatures from the Kingdom of the Trench, I think they are.
Yes.
And they, you know, that's a really effective little sequence. Just prior to that, you have a scene where Mira is playing what looks like the panpipes.
Yes.
And it looks like she's playing the panpipes without a hint of irony.
I don't think it's panpipes technically, aren't they? The row of pipes, and she's only playing like a recorder.
Okay.
I don't know what it's called, but that,
yeah.
Right?
Either way, this is not the sort of thing that you play seriously in a film. So I think, he's in the joke here. He's in the joke.
Because he's a very funny guy.
He's a funny guy, smart guy, knows what, you know, he knows his tone, getting the nail in it.
Yeah.
And then there are other things that are so cheesy that sometimes I'm not so sure.
I did wonder that as well. I felt like it didn't always give you the impression it was in on its own joke. And I wonder, therefore, how serious it was. Maybe that's a function of trying to smuggle a film as weird as this into a big studio franchise. You know, maybe that's what you have to do. You have to be able to stand there and go, no, I really believe all of this. I don't know. But it is, you're right. It's, the tone is kind of all over the place. And the only reason we're not complaining about that more is because there's so much happening that we were kind of entertained anyway.
Yeah. And can we just applaud just how weird and how completely and utterly comic booky this film is for a start? Because when we started doing spoiler specials like this back in 2012, back in the days of the Avengers, which, I mean, the craziest thing now, you look at the Avengers, and I love that film to bits, but the craziest thing that happens in that is some aliens open a wormhole from space and a ship floats. That's it. Mm. Otherwise, it's fairly mundane. Loki goes to the opera. You know, someone gets him a magazine. It's not exactly high-octane stuff, is it, compared to this? Then in the same month, in the same day, in fact, over here, both films opened in the same day. We have Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and we have Aquaman. There's stuff that happens in this film. There are images in Aquaman and Spider-Verse that I never thought I would see on the big screen. Incredible images. He really goes for it towards the last half hour or so here, James Wan.
Also, in terms of images, it's actually a very painterly film, I think, in a lot of ways.
Oh, my God. Shot of them going down, pursued by the...
Well, that's very William Blake, isn't it?
It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous. But also, the shot of some of the ruins of Atlantis seems... really, really Tower of Babel by, is it Burgle the Elder? I don't know how to pronounce it, but him. But there's a lot of stuff in here that's genuinely, I think, high art as well as low art, and deserves a mention. But also the shot in the trench also reminded me of Pitch Black very much. You know, you've got the same idea of the swarming giant crowds of things, and then that huge battle between the, you know, crab, the people of the brine, and everybody else. It's weird.
But this film, you know, this film is crazy. It's crazy. And I applaud that. I applaud the fact that, you know, we may talk about this as being a storytelling deficiency as well, Helen. But it is a sort of film where, as you said, there is a massive tsunami that is triggered in the first act. Yeah. And it's barely mentioned again.
That's it. There, you know, we see a news report, so it clearly has happened. You know, we see that people are affected. It is a big deal. But that's it. There's no urgency to, you know, avenge the dead. There's no worry for the dead. There's no obvious problems in Sicily, even though we're told this is a worldwide event. Everyone's pretty much cool there.
Oh, we're told that, are we? I missed that.
Yeah, they do say worldwide. So they go up on the shore of the Sahara, and there's nothing there. And also the fact is, the idea is that they've thrown all the rubbish out of the sea at us. But then you go down, and almost the next scene, Mira's got her ship parked in a sunken container from a container ship, which is surrounded by other sunken containers from container ships and a whole bunch of other rubbish. So that confused me a little bit on a second viewing. But, you know, it's a huge deal. It should be a big deal, and it's never mentioned again. There's huge amounts of damage to the Atlanteans themselves and to the people of the brine and all that in the final battle. again, there's no real sense of casualties having been sustained there. And I know I've gone on about this before in many, many spoiler podcasts, but I do feel like the weight of human life should mean something, and, you know, fish life or whatever. And it doesn't always when you get to that level of destructiveness, and I find that slightly psychotic.
I didn't know whether the fact that they don't really mention the tsunami stuff much after the after it happens, I didn't know if that was supposed to be a bit of a commentary on the fact that we are kind of, in the real world, polluting our oceans, and global warming is causing all of these catastrophes, and obviously it's hugely tragic, and the world pays attention when this stuff happens, but we're not really doing anything about it in a massive way.
But that's different from a massive event, though.
And I think part of the confusion around that is I didn't really get a sense of this, of how much humanity knows that Atlanta exists, because obviously they know about Aquaman, they know that he is sort of a meta-human, but then there's a guy on the news who's being dismissed as being a crazy man because he says that he's an Atlantean. And I think there was a bit of a confusion there over when the tsunami tidal wave stuff happens. How much does humanity know that that is a force beneath the sea?
Well, I think the idea is that they don't.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, again, you could do so much more with that. You know, John Wyndham's The Kraken Wakes basically is an entire book about a war between something that lives in our ocean and us. There are films to be made that are just about that. And I get that this film is about averting that war. But at the same time, this is if as reported on those news shows, if it was just one little tidal wave in one little area of Maine, then fine, maybe. But it's genuine. They say it's a worldwide event. And that means there is no scenario for that which doesn't leave at least tens of millions and probably hundreds of millions dead.
I just thought that they just lobbed a big ship at off a curry, but yeah, clearly it is and obviously it was enough to make the news.
Yeah, but there's literally footage of Brazil having it as well. It's they say worldwide, okay. And maybe it's only they mean, you know, Atlantic.
I will say that does bring one of the film's big unanswered questions, and this is one I didn't get a chance to ask James Wan. I had a really tight for time at the end. I had a choice of two questions. I didn't go for the erection one. I think I'd already asked that. But it was either, why did you cast Julie Andrews as the most powerful creature on the planet?
I mean, that makes sense.
And where is Superman? And I went for Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
Because I thought that he would just give me a kind of total party line. Oh, Superman's away. Kind of, and it's the same question that you ask whenever you watch, you know, you watch Thor the Dark World or you watch Iron Man 3. You know, why are we with Tony Stark? Why doesn't he give his super friends a call? You know, why doesn't Thor just call up Tony Stark when he arrives on Earth? My question is, where are the Justice League at this point?
I am actually okay with that, because this is an internal Atlantean matter, isn't it? Because
hasn't the world just been threatened?
Maybe Superman is off fixing everything after that. I don't know. Maybe that's why there's no mention of it again, because he sorts everything out, which somehow, I don't see how, but fine. But it would make sense to me, in the same way that, you know, a couple of the Marvel movies have hand-waved that issue as, this is an internal thing, we need to sort this out for ourselves. But to an even greater degree, I think there's more reason for them to say that in this case, purely on the basis that as the problem is presented to him, he needs to get Orm out of the way, which means he needs to just beat him in a fight and take control of the throne, and then job done.
Yeah.
Everything's fine.
Yeah.
So, and he, I don't think, initially doubts his ability to do that, so he has no reason to particularly worry, maybe.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
But,
all right.
But maybe it's that.
Someone else has pointed out, we do have some listener questions, and we will be tackling those in due course, but someone pointed out, I don't know whether it was a listener, it's just someone I saw on Twitter. Someone asked whether this does in fact take place after Justice League, because in Justice League, Arthur Curry and Mira have a conversation, which he doesn't even really seem to know her name. I mentioned this to James Wan. His answer was non-committal, necessarily. But I think it is. I think it takes place after Justice League, because that's the movie that announces him to the world as an entity. And in this movie, he's famous enough that people are wanting to take selfies with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that'd be after Justice League. Then again, there could be the idea that this is basically they're just kind of soft rebooting it and not really mentioning the fact that Justice League happened. Although I believe Steppenwolf is mentioned.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so what's your take on that? Where do you think it is? This pre-Justice League? Is this a soft reboot, or is it post-Justice League?
I think it's a post-Justice League, slightly soft reboot, a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm with Helen on that. And I think, to be honest, it's kind of, I kind of admire Warner and DC for that, of just going, look, if you've seen the other films, you can find the notes that this is, to an extent, a continuation. But I think after some of the previous films, which I'll say I'm not a huge fan of most of them, that they felt the need to get the big stuff right. The little grace notes, we can do those later, but let's, in the main, get the big things right, make a really fun big blockbuster that people want to come and see. And I think they pretty much achieved that. Well, it was all over the place as it is. It is entertaining and it is fun. I think they've done that with Aquaman, and I think that'll be something that I'd hope to see in future DC films, is for them to start kind of bringing those little grace notes and those bits of connective tissue, now that they've started to sort out the kind of main thrust of the storytelling.
Let's talk about the big guy himself. Let's talk about Jason Momoa as Arthur Curry. What do we make of him, his hero's journey? He starts out as a bit of a swaggering dude bro. He leaves Black Manta's dad to die, which is an interesting place to put your hero at the beginning of any story. Obviously gives him something to come back from, something to be redeemed for later on. Or you may even argue that he doesn't need to be redeemed because Black Manta's dad was a bad'un. What's your take on him? Where do you stand on Jason Momoa? Carefully, I imagine, because he's massive.
Yeah, although he probably wouldn't feel it.
He wouldn't, would he? We'd be like, walking up and down his back, he'd be like, what's happening?
Yeah, so the intro with the basically powerlifting an entire submarine through the water was quite cool, although I did sort of think for a minute...
He did that for real.
Yeah, I believe it.
Genuinely.
It made me think of Wonder Woman lifting the tank and the coolness of that very much. That first scene is just a hilariously, look at this guy, he's so cool. And I wish there was more physical fighting in the film, because he's really good in those scenes. He's really really funny, but also there's so much kind of swagger to those moments that you don't really get when he's flying around with a trident underwater. So I like that a lot. I really like him. I don't think he's like the comic book character, but I don't care because I think he's more fun.
I like what you wrote in the review this version does seem tailored to Jason Momoa, and it's like he's just come out of the ocean a bit hungover and plopped straight onto set, and they've just rolled with it there. And I did like that, because I think the amount of craziness that's going on around him, you need that slight air of like, I don't know, I'm just here because I guess I'm the Aquaman.
He's just like, he's totally unfazed by everything. And maybe that's a function of growing up in two cultures. I also, by the way, they brought in a lot of his actual heritage into this. There's that line from Temuera Morrison about, we should go home and work in your tamoko. I apologise, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. But that's the Maori tattooing. Mm-hmm. So they're still trying to, honour his heritage in that way, which I really, really loved. And I think there's a lot of times where he's saying things almost under his breath. They don't sound like English. So I think, again, he's bringing that into the film, which I really, really enjoyed as well. And he just brings a huge amount to this character who... I don't know who loves Aquaman as a character. They might love him as a concept and as a world and as an interesting thing to explore. But do you know what I mean? Like, character-wise, what do we know about him? What do we think about him as a character? I've never thought that much about his inner life.
I'm sure there are fans who are very much into the comic book incarnation of Arthur Curry. There's a person on Twitter, I don't remember your name, but there's a person on Twitter who is desperate for me to address criticism I made apparently on the Batman Superman spoiler special of Jason Momoa's casting as Aquaman 2 years ago. I think that criticism at the time was entirely valid.
What was the nature of the criticism?
No idea. I'm sure at the time we thought it wasn't the best piece of casting in the world, because you had cast this actor who'd been in Game of Thrones, who'd been Conan, who was largely known for being basically a great big hulking lump of meat that could deliver lines occasionally and swing axes and punch people. And he was in that Stallone movie, Bullet to the Head. And he was, fine in terms of his physicality, but we weren't sure whether he had the acting chops to pull this off. I think he's very good in this movie. I have to say, I hold my hands up. I think he's got a lot of charisma to burn. He handles the physical stuff very well. You just have to mention his name, and Helen has a dreamy, faraway look in her eyes. So like, he shakes his hair like that.
The way he flicks his hair in that first scene, there's something about it, man.
Yeah, there's something about it.
Maybe the lack of a shirt, I don't know, but there's something.
Was he not wearing a shirt? I hadn't noticed. It would be newsworthy in this movie if he did wear a shirt at any point in the film.
His shirts are also good, though.
They're all good. Yeah. But the thing about Momoa in this movie is that it's a sort of performance that is filled with charisma, and he handles the comic stuff deftly. He looks great in the hero moments. It just makes you want to go to all the people who cast him as heavies in movies previously and go, what were you doing? Because there's someone here who's capable of much more.
Yeah.
And I hold my hands up about that. I didn't think he was capable of hitting these notes in that performance. I think he's very, very good in this. And
Helen was talking about the fight scenes that he has early on, the like kind of proper hand-to-hand combat stuff, and I think he's very good in them. But one thing that I really liked here was James Wan, action director, because the action stuff in Fast and Furious is obviously then kind of big CG spectacle kind of stuff, and he does a lot of that here as well. But I really liked the way that he shot those fight scenes, or I thought they were interestingly done, that they looked distinctive to a lot of other big fight scenes, especially the submarine fight towards the start, where you can tell that, I mean, it's overcranked, but you can tell that he's thought about the angles that he's shooting at, what's a cool way to frame this moment, or to just kind of zing that up a bit, rather than be like, we'll plonk the camera here and you have a bit of a fight. And the same with the Nicole Kidman fight scene at the start as well, where the camera kind of zooms out and it's all this kind of big flowing motion stuff. And I love that it feels kind of a piece with that big flowy camera work that he does on things like the Conjuring movies, but bringing that sensibility to action scenes, to really well choreographed fight scenes. I loved that. And I think I missed a bit of that towards the end of the film when it just becomes big CG spectacle. Because that was a side to James Wan that I felt like I hadn't seen before, but also felt kind of a piece with other things that he'd done.
Interesting. I think he's a really good director. And he's he handled action very, very well in Fast and Furious 7. I thought that extended bus chase sequence in Azerbaijan is 20 minutes of just glorious mayhem.
And all the flying cars.
All the flying cars. what's not to love about that? I really applaud his commitment to making each action scene almost a oneer in a weird way. Almost every single action scene in this is one shot, or the impression of one shot. I like the way he tries to vary the staging of it. I love that action sequence in Sicily with Black Manta and chasing after Arthur and Mira, and going through the different buildings. And I think it's all pretty solid stuff.
Scusi, signor.
Precisely.
I agree. I think he's a fantastic action director. I noticed there's a copy of the Dulwich Horror by H.P. Lovecraft on the on the table in the lighthouse at the beginning. I don't know if that's a clue to something he's planning in the future or a tribute to a fave, but
yes,
there you go.
Another thing I meant to ask him. Damn it. I have to get him back in now.
I kind of wish he'd just given us a couple more quiet scenes just to kind of breathe a little bit.
Yeah, I get a little bit
less politicking I could have done with. You've got Orm rounding up all the different nations. I mean, the fish people, they look like the Narn from Babylon 5, if you remember. Ambassador Jakar, just me.
Babylon 5 is a big pile of shit.
Don't you dare.
It was a space reference.
I know it was a space reference. We all know it was a space reference, but we've heard that reference and it was wrong.
Bad Ben. Reference for Babylon 5, not even
Can't
Babylon 5 itself.
You didn't respond with your own space reference.
I'm just not going to do it.
Get out.
I can't justify it. I can't dignify it.
I think it is interesting that, a lot of the sort of undersea Willem Dafoe Orm stuff was very Phantom Menace for me, and I think it's really interesting starting to see that slightly prequels-y aesthetic starting to creep back into big blockbustery things. There was just some of the way that things, some of the underwater stuff was done was quite, I don't remember the name of the Gungan underwater stuff from the Phantom
Menace. Gunga. You don't remember the name of the Gungan capital?
No, I don't.
Boss Naz. Oh my god.
But some of that visual style is now coming back in as a sort of aesthetic choice, which I don't really have an opinion on. I just find it interesting. But I did find it a bit weird that the film kind of goes between being so all out and crazy and then also spending a lot of time doing undersea politics of who has different bits of the ocean. And
also that thing early on, I mentioned this in passing, but I didn't want to spoil it in the review section. So the submarine that he defends against the pirates.
Yes.
Is being stolen on the orders of Orm, Patrick Wilson's Orm, to use in a false flag attack on Dolph Lundgren, right?
Playing himself.
I forget his name. I apologise. I do have it written.
King Dolph.
Dolphin Lundgren.
King Narius.
Narius the King. Okay.
So he uses that in a false flag attack, which is, he's obviously then basically rescued it from the ocean bed, restored it to enough working state to use, and then used it to fire upon the Atlantean leaders. And then that allows him to be a big hero and save the day. And then it's basically never mentioned again.
There are many things this movie never mentioned again.
I just, like, shouldn't that be a thing? Hey, by the way, the humans didn't do that. It was somebody else. You know, but I guess that might get in the way of the whole, not quite redemption, but at least hope for Orm at the end. Mm-hmm. He's like, he's got his mum back now. He's going to be doing some serious bonding. Momoa says, you know, when you're ready, let's talk. Like, there's a bit of a future potentially for him. But I mean, the guy literally called Willem Dafoe his grand vizier. Surely there's no coming back from that. Like, surely he's just bad.
You would think so. Let's talk about Orm, and let's talk about the fact that there are obvious parallels with Thor and Loki in this relationship. And I feel that this movie is very aware of that. I think James Wan is very aware of that. And they're tying themselves in knots.
Trying not to
be Thor and Loki.
Sadly, I mean, I don't think Orm is Loki because I really like Patrick Wilson, but he just does not, that character does not have the charisma or the instant kind of draw that you have to Loki. And I think that's inherent in Loki's character because he's God of Mischief. It has to be something about that character that kind of hooks you in, but I really wanted Orm to be just cranked up more. I don't know, just because of the rest of the film is, I think he feels a bit of a blank space in there.
Well, it's a very clear choice they've made in order to make him the complete and utter contrast to Jason Momoa, who is this, you know, living god hewn from ancient rock with his flowing hair like he stepped out of all the heavy metal videos of the 1980s. And Orm is very buttoned down and his hair is swept back and there's not an eyebrow out of place. But I didn't feel any of his internal pain in the way that you did with Loki in the first Thor movie. I mean, you know, the thing I'm thinking about is that incredible scene where he confronts Odin and yells, "Tell me!" And he wants to know about his own heritage. And there's nothing like that with Orm. And he is a bit of a blank slate. I think Patrick Wilson's a phenomenal actor. And obviously he's worked with James Wan in the past and, you know, to great effect in the Country movies. And here he tries really gamely with a nothing role, but basically he's just left to strut around in front of in a green screen.
I mean, I think that's part of it, that he has dealt the worst of that. I didn't like the kind of, I never settled into the sort of people kind of, they're kind of half swimming, but they're also half kind of floating around and the camera's kind of floating around them while they're just in kind of dialogue scenes. I never settled into that stuff. I always found it distracting. And I think he had some of the worst of that to do because of his plot where he's just going around different bits of the ocean, kind of trying to pull people together. And I just found there was a constant sense of distraction around him. And the fact that that character didn't stand out anyway, lots of those scenes have just kind of washed away from my mind.
That's interesting. I actually admire the fact that James Wan, because everyone in Justice League was going, are they really going to have to do this every time someone has to talk underwater? Are they going to have to create a bubble around themselves? And I remember at the time he was going, don't worry, guys, I've got it. I've got an incredible solution for Aquaman. It's going to blow you away. And his incredible solution was to ignore it completely.
Completely.
And just not really
I mean, he's
mind
got
the
sort
that they're
of
underwater.
Weird thought beams going out when Jason Momoa talks to something non-human or non-human-esque. But otherwise, just ignore it.
But
I wish they'd ignored it even slightly more, because there was still a little bit of a sort of like gargle in the voices as if it was kind of travelling through water. And I was like, but even that hint, I was just, sack it off. We get it that they can just talk under there. But I don't know, I found that constantly distracting. For me, they didn't quite crack that.
Once you get into the movie, and it's a little bit like we talked about in the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse spoiler special, in a way that movie kind of retrains you how to watch that movie and how to watch that particular brand of animation. And so 15 minutes in, you're like, I'm not sure about this. My eyes hurt. If I forgot my 3D glasses, what's going on? And then it clicks and you go, oh, I get it now. And I think once you get past, and it's a little longer here, I think once you get past the first 30, 40 minutes or so of people being underwater but not really underwater, and you're very aware that it's all CG and you're very aware that it's just Patrick Wilson against a big green backdrop, once that clicks for you, I think some of the images that are thrown together here and the evocation of an underwater world is the most successful version of that world building for me since Cameron with Avatar. And I think that this movie is going to be, we're out after the movie is out. So, you know, if I'm wrong, okay, hold my hands up. But I think this is going to be huge for much the same reason. I think people are going to want to go back. They're going to want to experience that world again because it feels so markedly different from the shit sandwich we're dealt on a daily basis.
One of my favourite sequences was after Orm and Aquaman have had their fight at the beginning that goes wrong, and then when Aquaman and Mira are in the ship escaping, because that feels like the first time you get to really drink in that world, and it's so vibrant, and it's all the aquamarines and the purples, and I was like, this is so lush and amazing looking.
But, again, you know, that you've got the pursuing ships shooting at them in a very crowded and built-up urban environment. I mean, they're basically living in kind of Tron. And again, the score at that point, very unsubtly, goes full-on Tron. I also question the wisdom of building your undersea city right next to a lava field as well as the lava you've got in the arena. But fine, that's another problem, and I'm not supposed to worry about physics, Helen. But yeah, I mean, seriously, the massive, massive body count within Atlantis itself would surely be a problem. I also have questions about which animals they teach to play the drums, which ones they domesticate to use as large buses, and which ones they eat, if any.
So by going by what Nicole Kidman does in the opening minutes, they eat fish,
yeah,
but then they also
domesticate
ride
fish,
big fish. That feels mean. But then I guess we eat small creatures, but then
that's
also
true.
Befriend larger creatures. So
This is very true.
I guess it makes sense. I'm just interested, but we don't really teach any creatures to play the drums.
We taught Phil Collins. And that advert, there was a gorilla.
There was a gorilla. You're right. You're so right.
So
he's like the drum-playing gorilla.
The drum-playing gorilla.
Okay.
Shall we just point out that this is the second film this year to feature a large animal playing drums, which also stars Randall Park? Can we just point that out?
Yes.
And if
Ant-Man
Ant-Man and the Wasp and the squid from this movie got together and formed a supergroup.
The dream.
It is the dream, isn't it?
It's truly the Marvel DC crossover everyone wants to see. If they were going to do one, it should be a music film about rivaling underwater and above water drummers, each trying to make it in a world that wasn't cut out for them.
Absolutely. What would you call that group? The Travelling Mandibularies.
Well, let's see, they'd have 14 limbs between them. Is there something we can do with that?
That's almost as many limbs as a polyphonic spree, so they're doing pretty well, this supergroup.
It would be like a prog group, wouldn't it? Between the ant and that underwater
polyphonic
octopus.
Squid.
Yes. Not many groups have two drummers.
No. Two drummers and nothing else. It's just rhythmic.
I know, you could have Mira
insanity.
On pipe.
Oh, there we go.
And Arthur on the guitar that plays whenever he appears.
Yeah, he doesn't actually play the guitar. He just flips his hair and then guitar sounds happen.
I believe that.
While we're on the subject of music, please can we talk about Pitbull? About the moment.
Do we have to?
We have to because I burst out laughing. You have like, I don't know, like 45 minutes, maybe even an hour, where it's kind of, there are fun, cheeky moments and stuff, but it's like, it's underwater fantasy, it's quite Thor-y, it's quite, oh, he's fighting his brother for the throne. Then they're like, we need to go to Africa.
Yeah.
Then suddenly you're just in a plane and there's a weird version of Toto's Africa playing, and then it turns out a couple of days after the screening that is Pitbull, and that was the first real moment of huge tonal, like, whoa, we're in a different film now. And it is kind
That was every scene from it.
Yeah, because that scene, like the little airfield and getting on the plane, felt very sort of The Mummy / indie. And then when they go down into the, you know, kingdom of the deserters, which is a funny joke, deserters, and they're in the desert. They goes a bit more, again, quite indie, but also a little bit Uncharted or something like that, a bit Tomb Raider, kind of puzzle to be solved. I mean, there's so many freaking films in this one film.
Yeah.
It's magic. I'm also really confused about the Kingdom of the Deserters was there before the Sahara was a desert. Okay, so that's quite a long time, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying. But they seem to be able to understand the languages totally fine. I mean, there's a whale skeleton, like, just sitting in the Kingdom of the Deserters, which suggests it was fully underwater. but...
You are applying logic.
I was still distracted by Africa at that point.
Oh my God, she should have been playing that on the flute, on the boat. That would have been amazing.
Need to go back in.
Yeah.
Need to go back in.
I mean, can we talk about Atlantis? Because it seems like it might be awful.
I thought we had, but yeah, okay.
No, well, not like the Tron city and the fact that they have no health and safety, but, you know, Nicole Kidman tells us there's no tears in Atlantis, you know, no crying in baseball or Atlantis. We have, Atlantis has a long memory, it'll never let me go, so it's kind of this vengeful place. Highborns never venture to the sea floor, so you've got a stratified kind of, you know, aristocratic class. It's always had a king, so it's clearly patriarchal and sexist. But people keep talking about Nicole Kidman's character, Atlanta, defiling herself, having a, in quotes, half-breed son. They call him a bastard. They call him a half-breed a bunch of times, actually. Even at the very end, one of the soldiers comes up to Dolph Lundgren and says, "It's true, the half-breed wields King Atlan's trident. He commands the sea." You know, they're clearly racist, basically. Mm-hmm. They're kind of the, you know, again, like in the, to put it in Harry Potter terms so millennials will understand, you know, they're looking for purebloods here, you know.
Read another book.
And also there appears to be a physical difference between the aristocracy and the people, in that the aristocracy can breathe in air and the people cannot. And that's creepy as fuck. So, yeah, I have issues with Atlantis. Mm-hmm.
But don't you think that James Wan...
Capital Punishment, too.
...is making an overt statement here about racism and about how it has infiltrated that sort of society in the real world?
I think he's making a conscious decision to have... Well, I mean, he was cast, obviously, by Snyder, but I think this is partly down to Snyder as well. But I think, you know, having a mixed-race lead is a really important thing. Talking about that as a plot point is really important to provide, you know, a role model for lots of children out there who may not have seen anyone who looks like them on screen before, certainly in a leading role. But the sheer fact of it being hammered again and again and again, you know... Atlantis, I'm not saying that the film feels this way, because I don't believe for a moment that it does, but Atlantis as a place, as portrayed in this film, is a total sinkhole of really bad values. And it's interesting that that's not really addressed by Momoa or anyone else.
I feel like I agree that it's not really addressed, but the feeling that I got a bit was that the film does think the same as you, but in that that's partly why Nicole Kidman... leaves, and that when she goes back, she's kind of forced into this horrible punishment for having a son above the water, and that I quite like in that sense of other superhero films we've seen where you've got a character who then ascends to the throne, and that part of that journey for them is them saying, actually, no, we're going to do things a different way. That's something I'd kind of hope to see in a sequel, maybe. Mm. Would be Arthur kind of trying to reform Atlantis in some way, that he's a new kind of ruler. And
I agree. Yeah. I think that's got to be something that is addressed if there's another one of these. Mm-hmm. And I agree with Chris that it's going to be big at the box office, and then probably will be. But don't you need just a line?
It didn't give itself any time. There was time in the runtime. But
he complains about, you know, obviously his mother having been executed. Mm. He obviously is outraged by that. But there's no real... pushback on any of the rest of this, and I just would like, just literally one line would have been fine with me, but I think it would have maybe helped.
Speaking of the execution, can we talk about Jurassic Park at the center of the world?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is going on in this film? I'm like, I'm with it, but it's
a classic Jules Verne idea that at the center of the earth there are still dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Obviously that's fine. That's canon.
We accept that.
But the portal to get there, what the heck's that meant to be? Oof. I don't know. I mean, and like if the Carathon has to get them out, then did she make a hold in the dinosaur world to do it? Are the dinosaurs okay? Mm. Like,
I don't think the dinosaurs are okay, because Nicole Kidman is wearing them all. I like that. Oh, this is a super comic book film this year where a pretty badass maternal character just fends for herself in a brutal place for 20 odd years, and until their offspring finds them. It's lovely. That and Ant-Man and the Wasp. It was very Michelle Pfeiffer in Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Yeah, I'd forgotten.
Where they forge themselves a cool outfit made from... things that they found in the bad place.
I love that she then stopped off in the middle of the war to get a dress.
Yes. priorities, you know?
Mm. Ladies be shopping, I guess.
Yeah. Who was surprised to see Nicole Kidman turn up? Raise your hands. As in, turn up after we were told many, many times that she had been killed.
She's definitely dead. Wink, wink,
totally,
wink, wink.
Totally, totally, totally dead.
Super dead. Couldn't be deader.
Super dead. No one is raising their hand.
I'm actively pointing both of my hands at the floor.
What do we make of Nicole Kidman? I have to say, she gives it her all, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's a badass. She's ace. And I love that she can do this and she can do Big Little Lies and the range and the playfulness of the roles that she's taking. And Destroyer, again, something totally different. But I love that she seemed really game for this and like she gets really cool fight scenes. I thought actually, considering the film doesn't have a lot of character, you actually felt quite a bit from her in a fairly limited amount of screen time. Yeah, she was wicked.
Mm. I was wondering as well at the end, so she turns up at dawn, you know, because that's when he goes on to the dock.
Oh, I love that it ended.
Yeah, it was lovely. But at the same time, like, did she time her departure from Atlantis so she'd get there at dawn? Was she like waiting around in the sea
this
just offshore?
This will be more atmospheric.
Waiting for dawn? I don't know. I was kind of wondering about the logistics.
Yeah.
Yes, I hate fun, and I'm asking too many questions about this film. But I, you know, these are genuine questions that occurred to me at least on a second viewing, and
because you don't really have time first time around to think about anything other than what the fuck have I just seen.
All you can do the first time is just hold on. I mean, but literally, I was sitting next to Ian Freer of this parish, and literally, occasionally, both of us would just be sort of going, "What the."
Yeah, so maybe she was waiting for sunset because Tamira Morrison only comes out at sunset.
Sunrise.
Oh, was it sunrise? Okay. But it would be really awkward if she went there and he wasn't outside and she was just waiting at the dock and she's like, should I go to the lighthouse? Is he coming to the dock? So she just kind of timed it. She spent a day watching him, working out his routine, just seeing if he still does the same thing, creeping on him, and then worked out a plan from there.
Wow.
She's capable.
She's very capable. I mean, there's no question about that. Although, again, like how technologically advanced are Atlanteans supposed to be if she's so spooked by a TV that she spears it with a trident? Don't they have TV? Why don't they have TV? They have all these shiny lights in their city.
She should go to Curry's.
Hey.
I knew that was where you were going. I'm like, no, TV. You wouldn't, surely.
For some reason, I didn't see that coming. And I should have done.
Do you think?
You should have.
There we go.
All right, should we have some questions?
Sure.
Yes. Not too many, because I think we've covered pretty much everything. But here's a question from Adam Higgins, who has the catchy Twitter name of AdamHigg80367022. I actually prefer AdamHigg80367021. Sorry,
oh,
Adam.
Harsh.
Yeah, harsh, but there you go. Fair, I would say. He asks, is the fact Aquaman on the poster has his magic trident a massive spoiler?
Yeah, it is, actually. Once you see that that's the trident and the suit, then yeah, it is a spoiler. I mean, having said that, you know, in superhero logic, do we really expect that a magical and powerful item destined for the true king mentioned in Act 1 will not turn up in our hero's hands by Act 3? Probably we don't. But at the same time, yeah, it's a huge spoiler.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the marketing for this has been like so full on, and it's working because a bunch of people are already going to go are already seeing the film, especially in China. It's huge, but it feels like something that for a film that a studio was maybe a little bit more confident about in the run up would have been held back. That moment, that reveal, because it was in there was like a whole 5-minute trailer for this with extended scenes, and it shows the suit at the end. They really gave quite a lot away that has obviously hooked people in. But it's something that I think ordinarily might not have been shown in advance, but it felt like all hands to the wheel here to try and show how different this was for a DC film, to kind of show people that it was going to go to that very comic booky place of showing him in at least a version of that classic kind of orange outfit. But yeah, it was a bit spoilery. It would have been it's a cool moment. I have no idea where the suit comes from because he just gets the trident, and I presume the trident then
so the body dissolves as soon as he gets the trident, and so the suit is just sitting there, you know, being washed by the water, I guess. Although I have questions about how you can sniff his armpits underwater. Anyway, so maybe water doesn't clean you that well.
Yeah.
But
it fits magic.
But it's probably a magic suit, right?
Magic.
To go with magic trident.
It would seem to be.
I mean, maybe Graham McTavish is the same size as Jason Momoa. I haven't seen them in the same place at the same time. I couldn't possibly see.
I would say it's highly unlikely.
Maybe it's Lycra. Anyway, puts on the suit. I was wondering that as well. Is there a stripping scene in front of Julie Andrews? Because that would seem wrong. Or Does it sort of magically just, you know, adhere to his skin? Don't know.
A spoonful of give me some sugar helps the medicine go down, if you know what I mean. Yeah, it's a spoiler, but ultimately, does anyone really care? We know he's going to get the trident. We know he's going to get the costume.
We know he's going to get the girl.
We know he's going to get the girl. What's the point? What's the point of any of it? Just call the whole thing off. Just finish after half an hour. Here's a quick question from Dino A. Paolo, who asks, do you think DC should concentrate on solo films or start setting up a Justice League sequel?
Well, what they've said seems to be that they're kind of just focusing on getting in each individual film right in whatever way that film demands. If that is the case, then that seems to be paying maybe better results for them than trying to tie them together did. So if Wonder Woman and Aquaman are evidence of that policy, and I think Shazam, from what we've seen, would appear to be evidence of something going off in its own direction as well, that would seem to me to maybe be a better idea. I'm totally okay with them just focusing on what works. And then if in a few years we're really, really keen to see these characters that we now love team up, then brilliant, let's do that. But I think, you know, there was always the danger, and I think Warners knew this themselves, I think they must have known, that there was always the danger of slightly putting the cart before the horse. Mm. You know, Avengers was a whisper in the wind for those first few films. It wasn't a confirmed thing at all. They kind of built quite slowly, relatively speaking, to that, compared certainly to Justice League. So I feel like there's, you know, there's a way maybe to get back to that that isn't direct.
I think as well, part of the joy with the Avengers was that you'd established all of these separate tones, and it wasn't just the heroes coming together, it was the tones and the flavours that each of those individual films and characters brought together. And I think the fact that the Aquaman is so distinct from anything else in the DCEU, it looks like Shazam is going to be really distinct and has a very clear vision of who that hero is and the sort of film and tone that they need. Wonder Woman was really kind of confident in what it was doing, and it looks as well with plugging that into the 80s setting for the sequel is going to bring a new flavour but still keep what we liked about that. That once you've established who all these characters are separately, that then you get the payoff of them being together rather than it just being here's a load of people that you recognise.
Yeah.
Time for another question, then we'll wrap this thing up. Mm-hmm. At Connor Hegarty asks, with everything possible that could have happened having happened in Aquaman, where the hell does the character go from here?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, what films are left for it to draw upon? The Ten Commandments? I mean, we haven't done anything.
Ooh, biblical epic.
Biblical
Aquaman.
Epic. Mm-hmm. I can see it. I could dig that. He's got the hair for it already. Mm-hmm. Although, arguably, he's already done that getting King Atlan's trident, I suppose. Damn, that might have been out as well. Okay, we can do this. Heist thriller.
I mean, there was already a slightly heisty, questy element to this, so that's kind of been done.
Hang on. Not rom-com.
What about...
Indie movie set in Minnesota.
Oh, like Mumblecore Aquaman. Finally give him and Mira the time that they need to talk things out slowly in a quiet voice for an hour and a half. Shot possibly in black and white, but although you do want the bright blue colours.
No, you want the colours. Okay. You want the colours.
You say Mumblecore, don't you mean Albacore?
Hey, because it's a fish.
Ben doesn't like fish puns. When he hears a fish pun, he says, I've had a cup to hear with that fish pun.
Stop carping on, Chris Hewitt.
There's a time and a place for everything, Ben.
Let me just bike this line of conversation right there.
I don't know, Helen. I'll have to mull it over.
Oh, God. Oh, you're a card. Card, Chris.
What the fuck did you just say to me? Unbelievable. You think you know someone for all these years.
What was the question again?
What?
I've got no fish puns. None.
Oh, I feel the hake flowing through you, Helen.
Oh, there you go.
There we go. Right.
Off the scale.
Oh, come on, Ben. Shut up, Ben. Alex Elms asks, Chiman Hunsu plays the Fisherman King. Mm-hmm. So are we now in an age of people being both in the MCU and the DCEU?
Yeah.
They then go on to say, it seems that for Marvel, he is Willem Dafoe, but for DC... he is Willem Dafriend.
That's true. German Hunsu is also, I think, in Shazam.
He is. He's the wizard Shazam.
He's two different characters in the DCEU.
He's two different characters in the DCEU, which I guess they thought he could get away with given his lack of his handsome face in this one. He's the one who looks like Jakar very much to me. And honestly, look up a picture of Jakar and you're going to agree with me. I'm just saying.
Jakar.
G apostrophe K-A-R. How do you know he's a good one? Because he's got an apostrophe in his name.
In Shazam?
No, in Babylon 5.
Okay, say it again.
G apostrophe K A R.
G apostrophe J A.
K A R.
Oh, Andreas Katsoulis, the yeah. one-armed man from The Fugitives. Oh, yes.
Sure.
Oh, yes. Sorry, you think he looks like someone
in
Aquaman?
Fisherman King in Aquaman.
Okay, hang on a second. This is what they listen
live
to.
Live Googling.
Live Googling. Fisherman King. Aquaman. All
and
right,
also,
okay.
That's another reason to hate Atlantis. I mean, they're really sniffy about the people, their relations, who spend all their time philosophizing and thinking. Thinking is not a bad thing, Atlantis. Don't be a dick.
Why did some of them become fishy and some of them...
become
not
crabs
so fishy.
And become some of the
oh my
become,
god, can like, we just address the good crab? The good crab at the end, I don't know the name of that character, but the briny
Brian
boy
King.
Who who wouldn't give in even when his life was threatened.
John Rhys Davies. Now somebody told me he was, I'd like to apologise for this, somebody told me it was Brian Blessed and it's not, it's John Rhys Davies.
This is an outrageous mistake.
I apologise.
You've endangered your career, quite frankly.
Clearly I have blindness for, you know, bearded English actors and I can, with wonderful voices, I can only apologise for that.
Okay. Apology accepted.
Thank you.
On behalf of all bearded English actors with deep, deep voices, I'm going to say, I've looked at the picture here of Chiman Hansu as the Fisherman King in Aquaman, and I don't think he looks like Andreas Katsoulis' Jakar.
He does look like Jakar.
Made famous, of course, in Billy Ocean's wonderful song,
oh,
Get Out of My Dreams and Into Jakar.
That is so
weird. Here we have. Okay, so.
Okay, we're going to hold them up for Ben. Let me just
Google along at home, people. Google along at home.
Jakar.
Okay.
He looks like. He looks like a Buffy villain, but I can't place which one.
I'll tell you who he looks like. Okay, you Googled along at home. Just Google.
The master.
Google Fisherman King Aquaman. Okay? You've all Googled that at home. All right, you've got this picture of Chiman Hansu as the Fisherman King in Aquaman. I'll tell you who he looks like. You know the 1994 film The Mask? So Jim Carrey at one point loses the mask
as well. Yeah.
And it goes to the bad guy, played by Peter Green, wears it, and he looks like Peter Green as the mask.
He also doesn't look unlike the master in Buffy, but also isn't quite as horrific. I think it's just the sunken eye thing, really, as the master.
But Andreas Katsoulis, what a great actor.
Yeah, it's the red eyes of the master as well, I think, gives it that kind of vibe.
Okay. So, there we go. Chiman Hansu, Randall Park, both in the MCU and the DCEU with this movie. It feels like a line has been crossed.
Chris Pine, I mean, okay, I don't know if we're counting Spider-Verse in the MCU, but...
I don't think we technically are, not yet. Not yet. But I see what you mean.
Close.
Not the first time. I think there is another actor who has been in both over the years, but... I don't know. I can't remember who it is. I'll remember. It'll come to... Who is it?
Chris Evans.
Chris Evans. That's who it is. I knew it was someone. But I'm pretty sure there is an actor who's been in both.
Okay.
MCU and DCEU. People are writing in and screaming at me right now. But anyway, that was fun. Live Googling. And I think on that bombshell, that is it for our bumper. My God. Bumper Aquaman spoiler special. Our next spoiler special will be up shortly after this one, and it is Bumblebee, which Helen here spoke to the director, Travis Knight, and then we waited on for less time than we did about Aquaman, you'll be delighted to know. The regular podcast is off for the time being, but it is back on January 4th, and then, of course, our live show is happening as well, February 6th at King's Place in London. Do come along to that. Tickets should still be on sale at www.kingsplace.co.uk. Right, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
The land and sea are one. Goodbye.
What's that from?
It's from Aquaman.
It's from what?
Aquaman. You wouldn't have heard of
What's
it.
What's that? Is that a film? Sounds stupid. Stupid, Helen.
Well, stupid is as stupid does, Chris.
It's goodbye from Ben Travis.
You can see, but I just did a hair flip right now, so that's nice.
Got me pretty wet.
Oh,
good
God.
Lord.
Get me out of here.
Because of the hair. You flicked wetness over me with your hair. Because you've just come out of the sea.
No.
What did you think I meant?
Helen, protect
me. You disgust me. You disgusting, sick humans. Anyway, and it's goodbye from me. Anyone fancy an Arthur Curry? No?
Yeah.
No?
Arthur Curry.
Murray.
Ruby
Murray.
Match.
Tennis match. Tim Heyman. Thought we love. 2-0. Right, that's it from us.
Good Lord.
See you next time. Bye.